Hi everyone, we have a special announcement before we begin this week's episode. Have you ever wished that you could walk around a city and be given a private, intimate tour whispered into your ears in a sultry tone by a celebrity expert guide?
All the time. Yeah.
Well, that dream is now a reality if you're visiting London. Ooh. Because QI has teamed up with VoiceMap, a brilliant self-guided tour app to bring you the first quite interesting tours, packed full of our trademark unusual facts.
And narrated by none other than Mr. QI himself, Sir Stephen Fry.
Whoa. Yeah. You simply download the app from the Apple Store or Google Play, select your tour, stick your headphones in, and get walking.
It's really easy to use. You can put your phone away because VoiceMap monitors your location as you're on the move, and it plays audio to you automatically as you arrive at each location. So it's great. You don't need to check your phone the whole time.
You can do it whenever you like, and like start whenever, stop, have a drink, halfway through.
Do it at 3 a.m. if you're interested.
Creepy.
We've got good street lights here in London, so you know, you'll be able to see everything. We've put two London tours together so far, one of Westminster and one of the City and Bankside.
That's right. So whether you're a first-time visitor to London or a lifetime local, you can take directions from Stephen and see the city from a whole new perspective. For example, did you know that
London is home to over 8.4 million trees, covering 21% of the city? This means that by the UN's standards, it can officially be classified as a forest.
That's so cool. I didn't know that.
I feel so healthy now.
Yeah. Or did you know that our most famous landmark, Big Ben,
keeps accurate time with the help of a handful of pre-decimal coins? A single penny balanced on the pendulum can speed the clock up by 2/5 of a second.
Who uses cash these days?
Yeah, only our clocks.
Well, yeah, only our clocks. That's where it all is.
You might discover how
London's classic red phone boxes were actually based on a tomb.
Oh, they do look quite like a tomb, actually.
So, what's not to love? To get started, just visit qi.com/voicemap.
If you're not going to be in London anytime soon, you can still get involved. You can listen to the tours virtually, just like a podcast or audiobook.
But before you crack into that, make sure you enjoy this week's episode of Lunchbox Envy.
Hey. This week on Lunchbox Envy, it comes red or white, but also orange, grey, green, brown and blue.
It takes 700 grapes to make one bottle.
And King Charles has a customised car that uses it as a biofuel.
Of course he does. It's wine o'clock. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elf Manu. How are you doing, Manu?
Good. How are you doing, Jack?
Excellent. I'm enjoying this episode already.
We are also joined by food writer and chef Rosie McKean. Hey, Rosie.
Hello, Manu. Hello, Jack. Nice to be here.
So we should probably start with a drink. Can I pour you guys one?
Please.
Yes, please.
Okay. I've brought a cocktail for you all.
On Wine Week. You're bringing us a cocktail.
Well, it involves wine. Basically wine and Coke. But there's a story behind it.
I love wine and Coke.
Yeah, didn't you say the other day it has a name?
I used to drink it was when I did my year abroad in the Basque country in northern Spain, País Vasco. Cool. And they call it Calimocho.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so good. It was the best drink on a night out, I swear.
So it's dangerous though, because you can't taste that much alcohol in it.
No, yeah. Oh,
and it keeps you up.
So in 1863, there was an Italian 25-year-old chemist, and he invented a thing called Vin Mariani.
Ooh.
And he was basically spicing up wine, and he combined wine with Andean coca leaf.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's
so
lots of fun.
Basically cocaine wine.
Oh, nice.
And it was hugely popular. By 1880, he was able to open a branch in New York. Amongst his customers were Queen Victoria, Emile Zola, Thomas Edison, Ulysses S. Grant.
Quite the roster.
Yeah, Mark Twain, Robert Louis Stevenson as well, who supposedly came up with the idea of Jekyll and Hyde, which was inspired by his experiences with cocaine wine.
That does not surprise me at all.
So I haven't brought any cocaine, you'll be pleased to hear. But will you be pleased?
Actually very disappointed.
I can pour you some of the closest thing we can get to Vin Mariani today, if you like.
Please.
Yes, perfect. Please.
Pope Leo XIII actually gave his permission. He liked it so much. He was like, yeah, use my face on the adverts. So it's like weird to imagine this voice of God being like, cocaine wine, delicious.
Oh, that's really nice.
It is a damn good drink.
So good.
Bravo. Bravo, Jack.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you very much. So wine, it's interesting. It only really grows between 30 degrees and 50 degrees latitude.
For the layman, when we talk about latitude, that's just like imagining the world and rings that go around the world.
Mm, the horizontal rings. Cool. So the equator is 0 degrees latitude, mm-hmm, and the poles are 90 degrees cool latitude.
So cool, either way, up or down, you're going to get, mm-hmm, hotter and colder.
Between 30 and 50 north or 30 and 50 south.
I see.
You notice there are like a handful of countries that make wine and are famous for it. Like, yeah, France, Italy, South, mm-hmm, Africa, New Zealand, Australia.
And now the UK.
And now, mm, the UK. Well, that's the thing, because London is 51 degrees north. So okay, it's just above the traditional wine growing regions. But with climate change, that is changing now.
Mm-hmm. I went for a drink with my friend yesterday and my friend had a glass of wine from Leicestershire.
Wow.
Crazy.
What
crazy to think that we're in a world now where we could drink wine from the Midlands.
It's our sparkling wine is amazing.
It is.
Again, with climate change and also like technological advances, there are vineyards popping up in Thailand and Brazil these,
whoa,
days.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's so cool.
And I looked up, the most northerly vineyard in the world is in Norway.
I bet that's, yeah, lovely wine. I like cold production wine.
You think?
I like mountainous, chilly old grapevine wine.
Mm. I thought you meant chili as in the country Chile.
Oh, sorry. No. I meant chili as in like production.
Cold.
Cold. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm assuming in Chile where they have lots of famous mountain ranges, primarily the Andes, they make some nice wine.
No. But I thought because there's the phylloxera pest. It was a pest. I think it's a small insect that eats leaves and that ate vine leaves particularly. And it, mm-hmm, decimated all the wine from France and Italy.
Oh.
And so we had to get American rootstock and then grow the vines from the American rootstock. So when you see old vintages of French wine, it's actually, we had to import the new, the plants from America, right, in the 1800s. It swept over the world. But There's one small section of Chile which still has the old vines because it's surrounded by sea and mountains, so the phylloxera could never get there.
Oh, that's, yeah, so cool.
So you can find like,
that is good,
pre-phylloxera vines in Chile.
Really old wine. Yeah. We should probably say what wine is.
Yeah, we should have started with that, really.
For the listeners at home who don't know.
It's fermented grape juice.
Woo!
Woohoo!
Lovely. So moving on.
Wait, but there are wines. You can make wine products from things that aren't made from grapes, right? Like, mm-hmm, like for example, Shaoxing rice wine. Mm-hmm. Sake is rice wine.
It's actually called something wine. Wine on its own as a word tends to refer to grape wines.
Oh, really?
Other wines, say if it's like with fruits or other ingredients like blueberries or apples or whatever, you can make wine out of all kinds of things. But also I was looking at the different, because I, in my head, I'm like, there's only three colours of wine.
Yes, we should talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. So many colours.
So I used to think red grapes equals red wine, white grapes equals white wine. But
and rosé equals red and white wine mix.
Yeah, exactly.
At some point in my life, I did think that. It's just like you pour them in the same glass.
Yeah.
Lovely.
But it's a bit more complex than that, isn't, mm-hmm, it?
Yeah. So starting from white wine, which is the juice of white grapes without skins on.
Oh.
And then orange wine. Very trendy at the moment. Juice and skins from white grapes. Okay. Which is why it's sometimes called skin contact wine, because they leave the white grape skins on, gotcha, for a bit longer. Rosé, not a mixture of red and white wine, but the juice from red grapes, basically without the skins. And then red wine, the juice and the skins from red grapes.
Right.
Okay.
Temperature, like,
yeah,
temperature of wine. You hear lots of differing opinions on wine temperature, but like there are some pretty explicit rules, like white wine should never be below 6 degrees, I think, but never be above 8 or 9.
Yes. The advice I heard was that red wine at room temperature, that dates back from when our houses were all much cooler.
Mm-hmm.
So these days with central heating and climate control, what you should actually do is put red wine in the fridge for an hour. And vice versa with white wine, it shouldn't be drunk at fridge temperature, which is 4 degrees. You should take it out for an hour before you drink it. They sort of meet in the middle, but not quite in the middle.
Yeah. So as a rough guide, if you're drinking white wines, light or sort of medium-bodied white wines, you're looking at between 6 and 10 degrees. So that is warmer than fridge, your normal yeah. fridge. For full-bodied whites, slightly warmer at 9 to 12. For light to medium-bodied reds, we're looking at 12 to 16. For full-bodied reds, 16 to 18. So that's why you'll often find those kinds of reds are served in bowl glasses, bowl-shaped glasses. It's because you can use your hand
yes.
to warm the bottom of the glass as you drink it.
And I was told that was why you have stems. So with white wine, you hold it by the stem.
Yeah.
And with red wine, you can hold it by the cup. So yeah. that your body warms it up slightly.
Yeah. And then rosé, 9 to 12. Sweet wines, a lot cooler, 5 to 7. Anyway, oh, I won't go on.
Nice.
And for our American audiences, you can do the conversion to Fahrenheit, your bloody selves. Okay, so it's time for our first lunchbox, and that today is Rosie.
What I've brought today is a very classic dish, which I think you guys might be familiar with.
Mm.
It is poulet au vin jaune.
Oh.
And this is otherwise known as chicken in yellow wine.
Yellow wine.
Or oxidized wine.
Interesting. Mm. It does sound nicer to say vin jaune than yellow wine.
Yeah. Now, essentially, my thought process here was chefs, food writers, gourmands will always say...
Old wives.
Old wives. Chefs will always say you should only cook with wine that's good enough to drink. Wine, I think, can often be a bit of a throwaway ingredient in recipes.
Mm.
We use it so much, particularly in modern European cooking. It's very, 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 very common. And that is thanks to French gastronomy being the sort of first adopter of that. So we're going to talk about it. We're going to discuss it.
Cool, let's do it.
Can I ask, what are your feelings straight off the bat? Like, do you cook with wine that is old and shit, or do you cook with nice wine that you're also drinking?
Well, famously, wine gets better as it ages. So I will rarely drink a whole bottle in one sitting, and therefore if I've opened one for guests, it'll sit by the hob for up to 4 weeks.
Okay.
And so it basically turns into vinegar, but once it's in the dish, I feel like my palate's not sophisticated enough to tell. But yeah, I wouldn't ever buy a cheaper wine in order to use it for cooking.
Okay.
I would use the leftovers from the nice wine that I buy.
Mm-hmm. Nice. What about you, Manu?
Never cook with wine, really.
You don't?
No, I grew up in a sober house, so...
Oh, fair enough.
The stuff that I cook regularly, if I cook, is not alcoholy at all. I mean, right. I know that you burn off the alcohol, but it's just never an ingredient that we had in the house. Yeah.
Interestingly, what I learned in my research is that you actually don't always burn off all the alcohol.
Yes, I read this.
Oh.
Is that actually it takes quite a long time
yeah.
to cook off a lot of the alcohol.
Yeah, it doesn't go in the first sort of minute or five even. Like, it can take a long time.
Yeah. So damn. What I learned is that if you do a sort of short evaporation, let's say you're whacking in some wine in like a bowl of clams or mussels or, you know, something that doesn't take very long to cook, maybe 10, 15 minutes, you will only get rid of about 25% of that alcohol.
No.
So it'll still be 75% present wow. in the wine. Obviously, when you add that to the whole volume of the dish, the liquid in the dish, it's a minimal amount no, in a larger volume of
it is
liquid.
For like Muslims, for instance.
Well, yeah, it is. For example, for Muslims,
I was going to say, don't listen to this bit, mum and dad, because they have been eating a lot of food
yeah.
prepared for them. Like, no, it's fine, it's gone.
So let's start first by trying this.
Oh yeah, that's...
So vin jaune is a special type of wine made in the Jura region of France.
Oh, okay.
And it's involves a unique aging process, which is kind of antithetical to how wine is normally made, which, as you mentioned before, it is tightly sealed to avoid oxidization. Mm. It's made from Sauvignon grapes, and the wine is matured in oak barrels without topping them up.
Oh.
For at least 6 years.
So they're not completely full.
So they're not completely full, which allows for basically a thin film of yeast, ooh, otherwise known as the voile, which also kind of means shroud.
Oh, God.
In French.
Yeast shroud.
A yeast shroud.
No.
Sounds like a woman's problem.
Oh.
It allows this yeast to naturally develop on top of the wine, on the surface of the wine, and that protects it from excessive or oxidation, but allows for a level of controlled oxidation. Mm. which is what develops this really unique flavor. And I think, you know, the most closely comparable flavor for those who've not tried it is it's kind of like dry sherry, like almost like a fortified wine.
Now, that's interesting because I knew they did it with sherry. That's how you make sherry. It's,
yeah.
It's the same yeasty layer. They call it flor in Spanish.
Ooh.
Oh. Mm. Well, I like that. That's a bit nicer than voile. Anyway, so this dish is very sort of like classic Jura cookery. Most often you'll see it with vangeon and morels. Morels, for those that don't know at home, are a type of woodland mushroom, wild mushroom. They're very interesting to look at. They kind of look like thimbles, like mushroom thimbles for your thumb. Give them a quick Google. They're quite interesting. They are bloody expensive. And whilst we do have some budget on this show, we don't have budget for that. So I have left out the morels. And I have made this with vangeon. And I've made it with some puccini mushrooms, dried puccini mushrooms that I rehydrated.
Nice.
And
yum.
I should have used poulet bresse, which is a very beautiful artisanal chicken from the Jura region.
With blue feet.
With blue feet, but I didn't have a budget for that either, producer Alex. So essentially, it's a very classic sort of French chicken preparation.
Oh,
your chicken
like
pieces are browned off, and then you add shallots and you deglaze with your vangeon. And deglazing with wine, it doesn't have to be done with wine, but basically it means when you add a liquid to a pan where has only dry things have cooked, there might have been a crust that's formed on the bottom of the pan, using a liquid to lift up that crust so that those flavors, as long as they're not burnt,
are dissolving
into your sauce.
Nice.
Oh, it does smell divine.
It smells incredible.
And then you braise it literally in the wine and a bit of, in my case, I used a bit of mushroom stock. I did do some research. There were sort of varying levels of wine to stock and wine to no water or other liquids. I did a bit of mushroom stock, which I'd used to soak my mushrooms in, and I did mostly wine. And then you finish it with some creme fraiche.
A triumph.
Hey, thank you, Rosie.
Let me pass this cutlery.
The sauce is amazing.
If I were to try and describe it to someone who's never tried it before, you've had chicken and white wine sauce probably. What's different about vangeon is that it's a lot more savory and nutty than normal white wine. White wine is quite light, quite fragrant. Jack's drinking from his bowl. I love that. Love to see that. Oh, I'm glad. I'm always really, no offense, Jack, I'm always especially touched when Manu likes my food, because she goes out with pretty much the hottest chef in London. And
thank you very much.
She's also a chef herself. So
have I got
I know
food?
I've done well.
Also, I'm a dustbin. I'll eat absolutely anything. Okay, where were we?
Let's talk first. What does wine do in cooking? So typically it's used for flavor. It adds acidity, depth, richness. You splash it in sauces, soups, braises. You can marinate with it. It's very versatile. It's a great ingredient. The components that shape how wine tastes to the drinker are the same things that make it good in cooking. And those are its acidity, tannins, alcohol, and sugars. As I said before, you do need to cook off the alcohol a bit because basically alcohol is really quite acidic. And acid is good to a point, but it can be astringent, right, if it's not cooked off. So you might have noticed maybe once or twice you've fucked up and you've not cooked your alcohol off for long enough, your wine off for long enough, and it's a little bit too winey. It's not sweet enough. You have to add some sugar.
Okay.
That's why. Alcohol is super useful in cooking, though, because it is primarily an olfactory flavor. And what I mean by that is it is something that you read through your nose, not through your mouth.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Able to enhance more delicate flavors by acting kind of as a solvent. So they dissolve easily in alcohol and they can be carried, permeated through the dish.
Oh.
It also bridges the gap from the nose to the mouth. A good example is vanilla extract. Not made with wine, to be clear, but vanilla extract is vanilla in alcohol.
Oh, yes.
You get a hugely concentrated vanilla flavor because the alcohol is carrying it into
it's
your
sort of
dishes.
Constantly evaporating.
Exactly. So that's why alcohol is useful in cooking. Tannins, we've discussed this before in coffee, they break down protein strands.
Of course.
And so they can be used as a tenderizer. We use them coq au vin. Chicken is marinated in wine and then cooked in the wine that it's marinated in. Tannins also bind to proteins, which lowers their astringency. So if you're worried about something being really tannic and dry when it goes into a dish, you don't have to worry because the tannins will bind to other things, to other proteins. Okay. A good example of this is having tea with milk. Because basically when you pour milk into tea, the tannins in the tea bind to the proteins in the milk and it becomes something else. It becomes very mellow and delicious. It's the same thing in wine.
This is why a lot of wine isn't vegan.
Yes.
That's exactly why.
Wait, why?
So in order to kind of counteract the really bitter and drying tannins, they'll put animal proteins in it.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is why, you know, you get the special, like, this is vegan wine, which you assume all wine is.
Yeah.
But that's not the case. So it's, cow and pig gelatin.
Doesn't it clarify the wine?
Yeah, I think so. But they also use egg whites and skimmed milk as well. Like sorts.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Finally, sugar. During cooking, the wine reduces, which we want it to do. And as this happens, the sugar gets more concentrated. And wine, as we know, does contain plenty of sugar. Recipes will mostly call for dry white wine if they're using white wine. And that's because there's less sugar in them, so they won't interrupt the other flavors as much.
How long should I be wary of keeping an open bottle of leftover wine in order to cook with? Is there a maximum limit?
Yes, there is. Basically 10 days.
Oh, wow.
And that's also caveated with it should be covered during those 10 days.
Yes,
it shouldn't
course.
Be left completely open. So yeah, so let's say you opened a bottle of Chardonnay on a Friday, 10 days after that. And if you haven't used it, don't use it.
Wow.
It will be too sour, heading towards vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would also say I've gauged from my own cooking over the years. If it's been 10 days or less open, you are not going to notice in a cooked dish if that wine is off.
That's a great rule of thumb.
Or oxidized. Mm-hmm. It would be noticeable if you drunk it. So if you had a glass of wine that had been sat by your stove for, God forbid, 4 or 5 days open, where we all keep it, let's be honest. No, it wouldn't be very nice. But you could cook with it. You could use it in a bolognese. You could use it in clams, something like that. The other exception to this rule is obviously if a wine has been corked.
Mm.
What exactly is that?
It's to do with the cork, which is from wood bark, reacting with chlorine, which is used to kind of like clean the wineries and treat vines and barrels and stuff. So there's kind of chlorine in wine production, which reacts with fungi in the woody cork. And it makes this weird, impronounceable chemical called trichlorophenol.
That sounds great.
But it creates a kind of musty, funky off smell. So that's corking. So firstly, you know when you are at dinner and you've ordered wine and someone comes up to you and they're like, taste the wine. And I always thought it was supposed to be like, yes, this is yummy. Give it to me, please. Oh, no.
Stop teasing me with this tiny pour.
Exactly. No, it's to test exactly that. It's to see if the wine has corked.
Yeah.
You're actually not supposed to drink it either.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm so humiliated.
likewise.
Classless.
It's just to smell if the wine has been corked. So you can just stick your nose in it, swirl it around, and then you can taste it if you're not sure, but it should be enough just to smell it.
Wow, I'm so gonna do that next time. Just sniff it and then put it back.
And just look at it and be like, I know.
I don't know about you guys though, but like, I have a dexterity issue where like I can't swirl my wine glasses in a cool way. Like it looks like I've got some kind of wrist spasm. Like I'm so embarrassed, and everyone's always like picks it up and is like. it's not a good look for our MPQ, unfortunately. But yeah, I hope that makes it feel a bit more accessible, cooking with wine, because I think we can sometimes hold ourselves to these high standards. You can freeze it.
I was gonna say that is like that internet hack just popped into my brain. People freezing their wine in ice cube trays. Can you actually do that?
Yeah, you can. It's like a stock cube but frozen. It's interesting though, because what you said about the fact that you'd be more likely to not buy extra wine than to use your 4-week-old wine at your stove, I would disagree with that.
Cheapskate. What's amazing is the price of wine is so relevant to its deliciousness.
Yeah, I was just going
to
say,
like 100%.
So they did a test where they put people in an MRI machine and then drip fed them wine. It was exactly the same wine. It was like a standard 12 euro bottle of wine. But they told them it was 3, 6, or 18 euros.
Oh.
And the way their brains reacted to those different price points was mad. Really? They all loved their 18 euro bottle of wine.
It's literal confirmation bias mm-hmm. in action.
But it works. Yeah. It's mad.
Okay, I think we should move on, don't you?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
It's time for my lunchbox. And I have brought with me today dried grape bread.
Oh my God.
Falling apart a little
Jack.
Bit.
Jack. I love it.
So this is an illegal way to get drunk in the 1920s in America.
It looks like the bottom of my lunchbox from like year three. To be clear, dried grapes are raisins.
In this case, yes.
Mm-hmm. Can I have one?
Yeah, go for it.
Perfect. I love raisins.
Nice.
I put a bit of glue on them.
What?
No, I'm kidding. I just wanted to mix it out. So a representation mm-hmm. of a thing that was sold in 1920s California.
Mm-hmm.
In 1920s in America, wine, what are we thinking?
Wine.
Pinot Noir.
No, prohibition. So prohibition was the... It's okay. And didn't expect you to get it. National law in America. It lasted from 1920 to 1933, which banned the sale of all alcohol.
Yes.
Even more famous now for all the people that got around it with the organized criminal gangs, e.g. Al Capone.
Just so I'm clear, was the intended purpose of prohibition just to reduce people's alcohol consumption?
Well, people thought it was morally wrong. There was a growing movement called the temperance movement. Basically, in 1920, it became a universal rule across all of America. And then the grape producers, particularly in California, noticed the loophole that you are only allowed to not buy alcohol. So they started selling grape bricks so that you could make your own fermented fruit juice. Yeah, exactly. So in order to turn this grape brick into non-alcoholic grape juice, you had to add water, but also this chemical, benzoate of soda, because if you didn't put the chemical in, you would end up with wine and you'd be breaking the law. So cleverly, what they wrote on the label was, and I quote, "If not consumed soon, this grape juice will of course ferment. And to prevent fermentation, benzoate of soda may be added, or the juice be kept in the refrigerator." So they were sort of implicitly saying how to make wine.
Yeah.
Despite explicitly telling you how not to make wine. Make sure to add this chemical, otherwise it will ferment and turn into wine.
It's very clever bit of marketing.
Yeah, I think so.
Like it. Mm-hmm.
And they were sold in flavors. You could get a Muscatel brick or a Riesling or a Burgundy.
And by flavors, you mean grape varieties.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's what they were very careful to say, is not technically wine. California's vineyards actually increased in acreage by 700% during the first 5 years of prohibition because everyone was turning to this loophole because you could make your own alcohol and you were legally allowed 200 gallons per household per year, which works out about two standard bottles of wine a day.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's crazy.
So people were making their own hooch and stuff out of these bricks.
Do you know roughly how many grapes were in a brick?
I do not.
I only ask because of the fact that we had earlier in the episode of there being 700 grapes in a bottle. If you could fit 1,400 grapes in a brick, that's two bottles of wine.
Yeah, yeah.
Lovely job.
Amazing.
That'll last you a Friday night.
The temperance movement was actually, I mean, as I said, it rose and fell throughout the 1800s in America and in Britain as well. In 1872, the Prohibition Party, with two capital Ps, they launched nationally for their, presidency bid. And they had other radically progressive views, like universal suffrage for women and for black people. So
I think a lot of the kind of oomph behind the temperance movement and prohibition was women who wanted to not get beaten up by their drunk partners.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of like feminist suffragettes who supported sobriety because there are a lot of badly behaved men.
Yeah.
But it was mostly led by women, as you say. In fact, there's one quote from an incident in Cincinnati. The women of Cincinnati laid siege for 2 weeks to a particular saloon, keeping a round-the-clock vigil and even rigging up a locomotive headlight to expose what was taking place behind the swinging doors.
Ooh.
They were so sick of their men going out and getting drunk.
I mean, fair enough. Now women can go out and get drunk too. Yeah,
everyone is drunk.
So let's open our final lunchbox, and that is Manu's. What have you brought, Manu?
I have brought with me.
Oh my god, that looks like some sort of medical equipment.
I know, it's so cool. It is a communion wine dispenser.
No.
I know, which...
It looks like an enema giver.
Ew. It's like a small bucket with a funnel in the bottom and a stopper on the top. And if you press the button on the top, it lets out a small amount of wine.
A dollop of wine.
They use things like this, not quite exactly the same as this, but they use them in kitchens for like filling up bowls of soup and stuff in like big commercial setups where you need to do like 1,000 bowls at one time and it needs to be exactly the same every time. They just be like,
It's so much fun. Like the first time I used one of these, not the communion wine thing, was to fill up pastry.
Yeah.
And do the little It was amazing. So the reason I was looking into communion wine was because the first time I ever got jealous as a Muslim in my childhood of wine drinking was going to mass with family friends. And there was this amazing bit of mass where everyone got up and they got drinks and snacks. And I wasn't allowed the drink and the snack.
100%. It's absolutely galling. I went to Catholic school my whole life and I am not even baptized.
Wow.
And I was... furious every time I went to mass.
So
I was so hungry. You're not allowed it because if you're not baptized or have you had your first communion, you are not allowed the wine.
I'm a Satanist, so I have no idea what's going on. And why do you have bread and wine?
So it's meant to symbolize the blood and the body of Christ. And it's not just any wine. So sacramental wine has to be natural. It has to be between 5 to 18%. The vineyard needs to be given the thumbs up by its local bishop.
Oh, wow. Before literally a thumbs up.
They're just like, yeah, that will do. And then in order for it to be sacramental wine, it needs to be blessed during Mass. Some churches drink from a single chalice, which I think was definitely a no-no during COVID. Other churches have like little shot glasses of wine, which they hand out. So you get your own individual little communion wine. And that is when this bad boy comes in handy.
Ooh. Yes.
So it's really cool. So this is not sacramental wine because I haven't done a mass and also I wanted to be respectful. Some of it's really expensive as well. So there are like specific church supply websites which I saw a bottle and it was like just under £200 for a single bottle of wine.
That's why they only pour a tiny fucking bit in there.
Because it's really mad. But there's also loads of advice about how to choose wine for your congregation. Make sure it's not too sweet. Not everyone likes sweet wine. So this is actually cranberry juice.
I was going to say, what wine is that?
Special natural wine. So that is the communion cup filler. Endless fun for your friends and family. I think we've spoken about this on QI before. The country that consumes the most wine per capita is the Vatican City.
No way.
Just because they're doing mass so often.
Yeah.
So in 2019, the average per capita consumption was roughly 99 bottles a year.
Whoa.
Which is a lot.
That's crazy.
I know. Craziness.
I guess they do have mass like 3-4 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
So in COVID, there were some churches in America and the communion wafer started going off because no one was going to church and consuming it. And the rules are such that you can't throw away the communion wafer after it's been blessed because it is seen as the literal flesh of Christ. And so these poor like church employees had to eat these moldy wafers before they got even more moldy.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's a real problem.
I really don't think Jesus would have wanted that.
Oh, God.
This leads me on to another question.
Mm-hmm.
Is communion wafer vegan?
So it would depend...
Animal flesh.
Mm-hmm, on kind of what your stance is when it comes to the Eucharist. So if you're Catholic, it's taught that it's like literally turns into the blood and body of Christ as you're eating it. Church of England is more like Jesus's spirit is in the bread and the wine, but it's not really his flesh and blood. So it's called consubstantiation instead of transubstantiation.
Con which as is... in not real. It's fake. Yeah.
And then you have Baptists, which believe that it's like purely symbolic.
Okay.
So it really does depend on where you're from.
And it also does, I imagine, depend on your stance on veganism, because it could be seen as consensual.
Yeah, yeah. But one interesting thing about that idea of kind of the Eucharist and cannibalism is that it's also linked to kind of civilizing missions and colonialism and racism, because whenever we thought about cannibalism and like history and anthropology and all of these kind of social sciences, it tended to have more to do with like other communities of people, like indigenous. Savages, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm. But no one would think about...
Those guys are wrong for eating humans. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, we'll just eat the, you know, blood
exactly.
of Christ.
Yeah. So there are scholars like Abby Real, him from the Trinity College Dublin, who are trying to open up this discussion about Christianity and cannibalism. It's wow, so yeah. interesting. So I was also looking into convenience communion. Communion on the go is a big thing, especially in America when you kind of got like New Age Christianity. It's so more like hiking and communion. So there's lots of companies that sell, you know, there's like tiny milk pots you get in hotels and stuff.
Yeah.
They're full of wine instead of milk. So little like shots of wine with the lid.
Like you get on a BA flight and you ask for a cup of tea.
Yeah, exactly. So that's got the communion wine in it. And then, you know how like ice cream tubs in theatres have the spoon in the lid?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
That's where they put the wafer. So it's like a little wine and wafer thing, and you take
that's so clever.
Is it sacrilege to dip the wafer in the wine?
No, they often do that. That's a way of taking
communion.
Like your whistle, so to speak.
Oh, gosh.
Wow.
But yeah, communion on the go has been taken to such heights as the moon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was the first...
communion on the moon.
Yeah, yeah. Buzz Aldrin took communion on the moon. He, like, snuck wine from his Presbyterian church, at which he was an elder, and took communion on the moon in his pod. But NASA had to cover it up because at the time they had just been through this whole big legal case with a kind of atheist and feminist activist called Madeleine Murray O'Hare, who was partly responsible for kind of stopping Bible reading in US state schools. So she was like, you are not going anywhere near the moon church. But yeah, apparently Buzz Aldrin wanted the moon landing to be like way more religious than it was.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Thank God it wasn't. Otherwise people might not have thought it was real.
That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials if you want foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod, all one word.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, do you have any parting wine recommendations?
Yeah, well, I guess for me, one thing that I'm finding in my mid-30s is that opening a bottle of wine is a bit sort of tricky because I'm never going to finish it because the alcohol is 11, 12, 15% sometimes. And that's too much for me on one night. So there are lots of mid-alcohol wine brands being launched at the moment where the alcohol is down to 5%. What I'm very excited about is called Future Chateau.
Future Chateau.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I've heard that name before somewhere, Rosie. I wonder where.
Well, funnily enough, my husband, who has worked in the wine industry for the last 5 years, is launching this product and it's finally ready. There'll be a white, a red and a rosé available and they'll all be 5% ABV.
That's amazing. Hey. So we'll leave you with this poetic assessment from Galileo Galilei. You said that wine is sunlight held together by water. See you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Henriot, Rosie McKean, and me, Jack Chambers. It was mixed by Liang Lee and produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.